The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service. And for the next hour, I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That is gsuggsinsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated January 30/February 6, 2023. As usual, it is bordered in red on the front cover with a narrow white inner border. Time is in large block lettering in black upon a bright blue background. Upon that background is an illustration of a partial mouth. It's bright red, very bright red, lipsticky type mouth. And what might be construed as white blocks for teeth are really the white portions of a zipper, because the zipper holder or handle, anyway, the thing that you pull, it's a zipper pull, and it's pulling the teeth of the zipper that are supposed to look like human teeth. And the zipper pull has a happy face on the bottom edge of it. And beneath that is written, "Zip it, the power of saying less." Turning to the first article, the brief, "Biden's Paper Trail" by Brian Bennett. There's a big black truck here in this photo. It's like a heavy-duty pickup, but then with a big black box-looking case, either on a trailer or taking the place of the usual pickup bed. It doesn't have any markings or lettering on it, but there are two people dressed in what look like military attire. They may be, oh, it says police on the back of one person's vest, but they're helping guide this truck, this black truck, into place near a white building that looks like a residence, but it may not be. Turning the page then to the article, again, this is by Brian Bennett. The discovery of classified documents at Joe Biden's Delaware home and former D.C. office tarnishes the president politically at a moment when he was hoping voters would credit him for a resilient job market and signs that inflation is easing. Parallels were immediately drawn to a separate investigation into a trove of classified documents the FBI seized in August at former President Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago club in Palm Beach, Florida. While there are significant differences between the two cases, the investigation into how documents with classification markings ended up stored in Biden's vacated Penn Biden Center office in Washington and a storage space in his personal garage in Wilmington, Delaware, threatens to undercut the larger bipartisan effort to label Trump as unqualified for the presidency, which he has already announced he will seek again in 2024. His critics argued the hundreds of classified documents found at Mar-a-Lago provided another example of Trump being a politician who regards himself as above the law. It is a narrative that Trump has promoted by baselessly asserting the 2020 election was stolen and by fomenting the January 6 attack on the U.S. Capitol to keep him in office. The investigation into Biden makes any potential decision to charge Trump for obstructing the Mar-a-Lago probe more politically fraught. It also opens up another avenue for Republicans, who now control the House, to investigate Biden and to keep the story of Biden's classified documents in front of voters, as Biden mulls formally announcing a re-election campaign. Speaking at the White House January 12 during an event to showcase his economic policy, Biden was asked about the revelation that his lawyers found more classified documents in his Wilmington home, in addition to the documents found November 2 in his former D.C. office, a fact the White House kept quiet until CBS News broke the story January 9. They discovered a small number of documents with classified markings in storage areas and file cabinets in my home and my personal library, Biden said. Asked by a Fox News reporter what he was thinking, keeping classified materials in his garage next to his Corvette, Biden said, "My Corvette's in a locked garage, okay? So it's not like they're sitting out on the street." The Department of Justice was immediately notified, Biden said, and his lawyers arranged for the federal government to take immediate possession of the sensitive materials. Biden may have stressed that timeline to underscore the differences between his own situation and that of Trump, who's under investigation not only for keeping classified documents in a storage area and his private office at Mar-a-Lago, but also for allegedly obstructing efforts to investigate and retrieve those papers. In August, FBI agents got a warrant to search Trump's residence at the private club after federal officials spent more than a year negotiating with Trump's lawyers over the return of any government records he still possessed. Prosecutors said in court filings there was evidence that efforts were likely taken to obstruct the investigation, and government records were likely concealed and removed at Mar-a-Lago. Voters are not the only ones who must be convinced of the differences between Trump's and Biden's cases. January 12, Attorney General Merrick Garland picked Robert Hur, that's H-U-R, as special counsel to oversee the investigation into Biden's handling of classified documents. Hur, whose work Garland said will be guided only by the facts and the law, has a reputation as a hard-working career prosecutor who has held senior positions in the Justice Department during both Democratic and Republican administrations. Trump named him U.S. Attorney in Maryland from 2018 to 2021. Less than 2 months before appointing Hur, Garland announced he was placing the Mar-a-Lago documents investigation, as well as one into Trump's alleged role in trying to overturn the 2020 election, under the supervision of special counsel Jack Smith. Smith will help decide whether to bring charges against Trump. Before Hur's appointment, Trump called on Garland to end the special counsel investigation into anything related to me because I did everything right, and demanded Garland appoint someone to investigate Biden, who hates Biden as much as Jack Smith hates me. Meanwhile, Representative James Comer, the Kentucky Republican running the House Oversight Committee, has ratcheted up his own investigation into Biden, asking the White House for logs of visitors to Biden's Delaware homes since he became president, dates of any searches at Biden's properties, and the names of aides involved. Biden is widely expected to run for re-election in 2024. Months of high inflation and economic uncertainty had been a drag on Biden's public support, but his poll numbers have been ticking up in recent weeks. News of a federal investigation is not how Biden's political advisors would have chosen to start the year. Here's a photo captioned, "Nurses in the Street." Lots of people, a whole crowd of people, mostly women, dressed in warm attire, or attire to keep them warm. Most all of them are wearing red hats with some insignia that I cannot read. And they have red, matching red scarves, and some have matching red gloves. And here we find out what's going on. Nurses at Montefiore Medical Center in the Bronx join in strikes January 10 at two New York City hospitals. Some 7,000 nurses walked off the job to protest labor shortages and working conditions following the COVID-19 pandemic. The union said it reached a deal with hospital officials after 3 days that would raise pay and boost staffing. These nurses, or whoever is protesting with the nurses, are standing on pavement. There are lots of vehicles parked on the street, and there are, oh goodness, rows and rows of large brick buildings and some trees also in the immediate vicinity. Some are holding placards that say fair contract for patients and nurses and on strike for better patient care with additional signage, unfair labor practice strike. And now to the bulletin. This is Why Pakistan's Food Crisis is Getting Worse by Simone Shaw. As trucks carrying subsidized flour arrived in Mirpur Khas in Pakistan's Sindh province, January 6. Hundreds of people mobbed them. The flour was being sold for 65 rupees, 28 cents per kilogram, less than half the going rate amid rampant inflation. One man, Har Singh Kolai, was killed in the crush. Pakistan's facing a food crisis fueled by inflation and a critical shortage of foreign currency to pay for imports. Cash-strapped, the State Bank of Pakistan says reserves are barely enough for 3 weeks of imports. In an effort to save cash, the government's holding up everything from medicine to onions at ports, says Uzair Yunus, director of the Atlantic Council's Pakistan Initiative. The current troubles are the result of unrestrained borrowing. Shortly after former Prime Minister Imran Khan's party came to power in 2018, he was forced to turn to the International Monetary Fund for a $6 billion bailout. The foreign currency crisis was made worse when the IMF first suspended its payments to Pakistan in 2020 amid the COVID-19 pandemic. As a result, food got dramatically more expensive. A 10-week delay in shipments of soybeans from the U.S. and Brazil, purportedly because they contained banned GMOs, drove up the price of chicken by 45%. Over the last 4 years, blue-collar workers in Pakistan have lost around 30% of their purchasing power, says Yunus. These are lower middle-class and lower-class citizens that basically earn $2 a day. Following Khan's ouster in April in a no-confidence motion, the succeeding government has gone from crisis to crisis. Further international aid is predicated on making unpopular decisions like raising fuel prices and hiking taxes. And another election's on the horizon, making the chances of the government's taking such decisions even less likely, says Yunus. And that's spelled Y-O-U-N-U-S. In the meantime, daily life is becoming even more difficult. You hear stories from doctors beginning to see adult malnutrition. People who've given up two meals a day, he says. People cannot make ends meet. From the brief news, good question. Why is the U.S. considering banning gas stoves? This is by Nick Popley, P-O-P-L-I. Federal regulators are considering a ban on gas stoves, presently in roughly one-third of U.S. homes, amid rising concern about increased risk of asthma in children and other respiratory health risks linked to indoor air pollution from the appliances. The U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission, CPSC, which can issue mandatory standards or ban products if no feasible change would adequately protect the public, says it's still figuring out the best way to tackle this issue. Richard Trumka Jr., a CPSC commissioner, tweeted January 9, gas stoves can emit dangerous levels of toxic chemicals, even when not in use, and that his agency will consider all approaches to regulation. The news has generated its own heat, but CPSC says any action would involve a lengthy process, meaning there are no imminent policy changes. Trumka clarified the agency cannot physically remove gas stoves from home, but instead can require new products to comply with its regulations. This could include requiring new homes be built with electric stoves or high-efficiency exhaust vents. The debate over gas cooking's health hazards began nearly 50 years ago when researchers in England and Scotland surveyed the parents of more than 5,000 children and found a positive correlation between gas cooking and asthma symptoms. But a slew of new studies have spurred fresh concerns. Researchers have found gas stoves release nitrogen dioxide and other tiny airborne particles known as PM2.5, both of which are lung irritants and have been linked with childhood asthma. In December, a study published in the International Journal of Environmental Research and Public Health found more than 12% of current childhood asthma cases in the U.S. can be linked to gas stove use. Certain populations, such as children or people who already have asthma, are more susceptible, says Brady Seals, a manager in the Carbon Free Buildings program at the nonprofit Clean Energy Group RMI and a co-author of the study. This gets into the health equity issues, since we know asthma is a profoundly unequal disease, as black children are almost three times more likely to have asthma. A simple safety measure people can take is to use a high-efficiency range hood that carries air contaminants outside rather than recirculating them indoors. Those without an exhaust hood should open their windows during and after cooking, recommends the National Asthma Council. But even that may not fully resolve the health risks. A study published in the journal Environmental Science and Technology in October found gas stoves can leak low levels of methane and benzene even when not in use. Some households may want to consider using air purifiers in their kitchen to improve air quality, though filters must be replaced often. Others may decide to purchase a single burner, plug-in induction cooktop for as little as $60, which can be particularly cost-effective for renters. Under the Inflation Reduction Act, anyone looking to swap a gas stove for electric can receive a tax rebate of up to $840, as well as up to $500 to help cover the cost of converting. Beyond the health reasons, switching to electric induction cooking is an important climate step. And there are potentially also cooking benefits that allow you to actually cook faster, says Jonathan Levy, chair of Boston University's Department of Environmental Health. Gas stove regulation is a hot topic in the restaurant world. An outright ban on gas stoves could have a particularly significant impact on East Asian restaurants, which often require very hot flash frying. But some chefs are welcoming the adjustment to electrification. Chris Galarza, a Pittsburgh area chef and founder of the commercial kitchen consulting company Forward Dining Solutions, says making the switch to induction has helped his team increase production and improved employee mental health because the kitchen is not as hot. A lot of chefs will say gas is king because that's how we've always done it, Galarza says. But we only started cooking with gas the last 100 or so years. So if you're really concerned with tradition, you'd be cooking on coal or wood, not gas. When it comes down to it, chefs are afraid of change. This now is the milestones page. Elected Kevin McCarthy, Speaker of the House. This small column is written by Eric Cortalesa. They say the 15th time's the charm. After four long days of House Republicans failing to elect a Speaker, Representative Kevin McCarthy finally got the votes he needed to seal the deal, ending a historic and humiliating standoff with ultra-conservative members of his party. The final vote followed a spectacle more befitting a television drama than Friday night C-SPAN. At one point, a frustrated representative, Mike Rogers of Alabama, had to be physically restrained by a colleague from lunging toward Florida's Matt Gaetz, who later joined others in clearing the way for McCarthy's victory. "That was easy, huh?" McCarthy said after taking the gavel. "I never thought I'd get up here." But in winning the battle, he's arguably lost the larger war. To convert most of his 20 GOP detractors, McCarthy agreed to appoint more members of the far-right House Freedom Caucus to the powerful House Rules Committee, which decides which bills come to the floor, and the Appropriations Committee. Moreover, he also allowed a rules change that will enable any member to call for a vote to oust the Speaker at any time. In other words, to gain the power of the Speaker's gavel, McCarthy effectively disempowered himself. Charged, Solomon Pena, a former New Mexico State Legislature candidate, January 16, with paying men to shoot up lawmakers' homes after he lost his race. Arrested, Italy's top mafia boss, Matteo Messina Denaro, after 30 years on the run, January 16. He's accused of involvement in dozens of murders. Declined, China's population, last year, for the first time in decades, to 1.41 billion people, according to official figures released January 17. Died, Jeff Beck, blues and rock guitarist, January 10, at age 78. And French nun, Sister Andre, the world's oldest person, January 17, at age 118. And died, Lisa Marie Presley, daughter of the King. This short article is written by Laura Zornoza. 4 days before her death at age 54, Lisa Marie Presley gave a speech at Graceland. January 8 was her father's birthday. Today he would have been 88 years old, she told fans gathered at the Memphis estate. "It's hard to believe. And I think he would be proud. I think this year has been an incredible year, and I think the movie was incredible." Presley was referring to Elvis, the biographical drama directed by Baz Luhrmann that includes the courtship of her parents on a military base in Germany. Her last public appearance would be at the Golden Globes, where Austin Butler won Best Actor for playing her dad. Presley was at her own home in Calabasas, California, January 12, when she went into cardiac arrest. She died later that day. She was the most passionate, strong, and loving woman I've ever known, her mother, Priscilla Presley, said in statement. A singer-songwriter, Lisa Marie Presley lived her entire life in the spotlight, including a 20-month marriage to Michael Jackson. She also experienced more than her fair share of death and grieving. She was 9 years old when Elvis died at age 42 and dedicated much of her life to her father's legacy. Her son, Benjamin Keough, perhaps K-E-O-U-G-H, died by suicide in 2020. 2 years later, she penned an essay for People. The subject was navigating grief, a theme now even more closely linked to her family. Grief does not stop or go away in any sense, a year or years after the loss, she wrote. Grief is something you will have to carry with you for the rest of your life, in spite of what certain people or our culture wants us to believe. You do not get over it. You do not move on. Period. From the brief news world, China's Lunar New Year threatens a grim COVID-19 toll, by Charlie Campbell. Harry Lee, that's L-I, wants to spend Lunar New Year holiday in his home village in northern China's Hebei province, but he's afraid of spending more than 12 hours on crowded trains and buses, lest he bring COVID-19 to his elderly parents who have not been vaccinated. It's been 3 years since I've been home for Lunar New Year, says Lee, a 20-year-old law student in Shanghai. I was vaccinated 9 months ago, but everyone around me is still getting sick. Many Chinese face a similar conundrum. For decades, the Lunar New Year holiday was renowned as humanity's largest annual migration, when hundreds of millions travel from China's freewheeling coast back to ancestral villages to feast and toast with elderly kin. During the pandemic, strict controls and state-led incentive schemes put the brakes on holiday travel. But December 9, China began completely dismantling its testing and quarantine apparatus, allowing the virus to spread like wildfire across the world's largest population of 1.4 billion. Officials who've stopped counting infections said January 14, nearly 60,000 people with COVID-19 died from December 8 to January 12. Still, that figure includes only victims who died in the hospital following a pneumonia diagnosis and excludes all those with underlying health conditions. Meanwhile, social media images of crowded hospital wards, overflowing morgues, and long queues outside crematoriums and funeral parlors point to a burgeoning health crisis. Around 900 million people in China had been infected as of January 11, according to a study by Peking University, or 64% of the population. Independent death toll projections range from 1 million to 2 million. January 14, Zhao Yahui, a prominent health official, said the national emergency peak has passed. But Yang Zhonghong, a public health expert at the New York City-based Council on Foreign Relations, says estimates should be taken with a grain of salt. With the dismantling of the testing regime, they cannot be expected to provide accurate information. Much hinges on what unfolds during the week-long holiday. Lunar New Year officially started January 22, but for many, the grand peregrination begins days earlier. The combination of millions of people crammed onto public transport, traveling to a predominantly elderly, under-vaccinated population in villages with rudimentary health care threatens to be a perfect storm. Professor Guo Zhang Wen, member of China's State Council's pandemic prevention team, urged people don't go home to visit elderly relatives if they had not yet been infected. You have all kinds of ways to show you care. You don't necessarily have to bring the virus to their home. It is another example of China's chaotic reopening since a spate of anti-lockdown protests erupted in early November. Maintaining zero COVID required diverting legions of doctors and nurses to conduct billions of PCR tests, while vaccinations were an afterthought. Meanwhile, jingoistic state propaganda lauded the nation's success in banishing the virus. As of December 14, only 42% of those over 80 had received three doses of a vaccine, according to government figures. Worryingly, those figures are also heavily skewed toward elderly living in cities, meaning those awaiting the Lunar New Year arrival of sons and daughters, nephews and nieces, and are disproportionately vulnerable. China's health system has improved in recent years, but villagers still seek medical care in the nearest big city rather than at neighborhood clinics. Despite President Xi Jinping's insistence in his New Year's address that he has put life first all along, China's refusing to pay even the reduced price that biotech firm Pfizer charges lower middle-income nations for its antiviral medication Paxlovid. They are the second highest economy in the world, and I do not think they should pay less than El Salvador, Pfizer CEO Albert Bourla said. Instead, Lunar New Year migrants have to care for themselves. Ji Chen, a professor of public health and economics at Yale, advises travelers to get a booster and bring fever and cough medication to their villages. This year's migration is unstoppable, says Chen, but it is never too late to flatten the curve. The brief news, Royals. Prince Harry's memoir deepens an age-old rift. By Olivia B. Waxman. The media blitz following the January 10 publication of Prince Harry's memoir Spare has one major theme. He has grown apart from his father, King Charles III, and his brother William, the Prince of Wales. Family tensions boiled over in public when in January 2020, Harry announced he was taking a step back from his royal duties because of what he saw as a lack of support from the palace staff over negative tabloid coverage of his wife, Meghan Markle. But passages from Spare suggest tensions go back to birth, an underlying resentment of being the spare, while his older brother is the heir to the throne. The book is jam-packed with revelations, such as Harry's claim he killed 25 Taliban fighters from a helicopter in Afghanistan, which experts say is dangerous to publicize. There's a long history of royal sibling feuds, according to Alexander Larman, author of The Windsors at War, The King, His Brother, and A Family Divided. As he puts it, think of James II, who began as Duke of York and then made a spectacular mess of being king in the 1680s after his brother Charles II died. Or Richard III, who, if Shakespeare is to be believed, brought about the deaths of both his brothers Edward IV and the Duke of Clarence to ascend the throne in the 1480s, only to be forced off it by Henry VII. Nobody's thinking Harry has had anything quite so dramatic in mind yet, anyway. In a January 8, 60 Minutes interview, Harry said he was going public about the drama because the royal family's relationship to the British press has made it impossible for him to mend his relationship with his father and brother. Every single time I've tried to do it privately, there have been briefings and leakings and planting of stories against me and my wife, Harry told Anderson Cooper. Harry reveals he and his brother William have been living separate lives since their mother, Princess Diana, died in a 1997 car crash. In high school, William told his brother to stay away from him. But Harry suggests that dating Meghan, an American actor, starting in 2016, strained his relationship with his brother even more. In early 2019, on the grounds of Harry's cottage at Kensington Palace, the brothers got into a shouting match over what he says were inaccurate stories in the tabloid press about Meghan. Harry says William shoved him so he fell down, landing on a dog bowl. In September 2022, when Queen Elizabeth II's health deteriorated at Balmoral Castle in Scotland, Harry says he was not invited on the family plane to rush to her side, and by the time he arrived, she had died. The brothers' feud is also about more than just their relationship with each other. The traditional ascription to the ill will between William and Harry is that neither of their wives like one another, and that has driven a wedge between them, coupled with a sense on William's part that his younger brother has behaved irresponsibly and selfishly in abandoning any sense of duty by staging his quasi-abdication, says Larman. It remains to be seen whether the family will come together in a public show of unity before King Charles III's coronation ceremony, May 6. Larman notes Harry's attacks on his brother can, in some ways, be seen through an age-old lens. Today we might not see royal brothers meeting on the field of battle, winner taking all, but instead we find them conducting their warfare via that rather more insidious weapon, the media, and hoping that the court of public opinion will favor one side over the other in a hopefully definitive way. From the brief Health, here's a page written by Angela Haupt. It features five ways to squeeze in more steps every day. Logging more steps comes with dozens of benefits. Walking is probably the most basic, most fundamental thing that nearly everybody has the ability to do, says Dr. Tamana Singh, co-director of the Sports Cardiology Center at Cleveland Clinic. It lowers your risk for major disease and helps control weight, blood pressure, cholesterol, and blood sugar. Walking even curbs the urge to indulge. One study found that a 15-minute stroll reduced chocolate cravings. Plus, it is gentle on the joints, and there's no learning curve to do it properly or safely. The best part, you can get these benefits with a few tweaks to your daily life, says Cedric X. Bryant, President and Chief Science Officer of the American Council on Exercise. For people who are not very active, it takes a very small dose, a few thousand daily steps, to elicit a pretty nice response. Here are five fun ways to seamlessly add more steps to your day. 1. Stop texting people who are nearby. What do you do when you want to talk to someone upstairs or down the hall? We probably yell and we probably text, says Bryant. Instead, get up, walk, communicate with them face to face. The same is true when you're at the office. Replace every text, email, call, or Slack to the nearby target of your attention with an in-person visit. Looking for every opportunity to move is a great way to collect more steps. 2. Get or borrow a dog. Research has found that dog owners are 4 times as likely as people without dogs to meet federal exercise recommendations, and they tend to take almost 3,000 more steps per day. If you do not have a dog, Singh suggests volunteering to walk dogs at an animal shelter. You're helping yourself as much as you're helping a little animal, she says, and they deserve to walk as much as we do. 3. Create some competition. A social way to keep yourself accountable is to recruit friends, family members, or colleagues for a walking challenge. For at least 8 to 12 weeks, set a weekly or monthly step goal and give some intermittent prizes, suggests Singh. At the end, whoever has the most steps wins a gift card to their favorite restaurant or a celebratory gathering in their honor. It's a friendly way to get something positive out of competition and still be supportive. 4. Have mobile meetings. When Bryant's on the phone, he says, I have a headset on and I'm moving the whole time. In addition to walking indoors or outdoors during calls, he hosts walking meetings with his colleagues. We know that disrupting sedentary behavior is very beneficial, Bryant says. You can do the same. Notify attendees in advance that the meeting will be in motion so they can dress accordingly and choose a flat path, ideally in a quiet area like a park. And the 5th, design an indoor circuit. To rack up steps without leaving your home or office, try a new perspective. Commit to climbing the stairs a certain number of times each day, which is an incredible way to build endurance, power, and strength, Singh says. Other indoor activities include running in place or on a treadmill, shadow boxing, and dancing, suggests certified personal trainer Michael Jones. They're fun and sure to get your heart rate up, he says. The View, Inbox, the D.C. Brief by Philip Elliott, Washington correspondent. When Gallup asked Americans for the first time about their trust in government, a mind-blowing 73% answered positively. Fast forward from 1958 to the present, a measly 20% now express trust in government, a near historic low. No single tidy explanation serves here, but it is lost on no one that Americans have soured on the notion of political leaders as unifying figures to be trusted to do the right thing. We have come a long way from President Dwight D. Eisenhower, the war hero turned executive, to Representative George Santos, a freshman Republican from New York who cannot make his way through a hallway without facing legitimate questions about whether he should keep a job won based on lies. So far, we know Santos did not tell the truth about his high school, his college, his faith, his CV, his money, his grandmother's Holocaust experiences, his mother's death link to 9/11, whether his staffers died in the Pulse shooting. Well, there's a lot that does not add up when it comes to Santos, who previously called himself Anthony DeVolder, and whose campaign finances rightly face scrutiny. Still, it looks as if Santos is going to keep his gig, although without any plum assignments. House Republicans have a razor's edge margin for governing, and they seem fine harboring a fabulous so long as he's a yes man to Speaker Kevin McCarthy. So when you hear your neighbors complain about government, remind them that it was not always this bad. Not that long ago, Americans trusted government because their leaders were, at a minimum, who they said they were. Health Matters by Alice Park, senior correspondent. In the third year of the COVID-19 pandemic, it may be time to rethink booster recommendations, says one vaccine expert who serves on the U.S. Food and Drug Administration's Vaccine Advisory Committee. In a perspective published in the New England Journal of Medicine, Dr. Paul Offit makes a case for why it may be time to reconsider blanket booster recommendations that apply to everyone equally. For one, the latest Omicron booster, a bivalent dose that targets both the original and Omicron BA.4 and BA.5 variants, is no longer up to date. When it was authorized in August 2022, the BA.4 and BA.5 variants were expected to cause most of the new infections in the U.S. Now, different Omicron variants like XBB have taken over. In addition, studies show people who receive the bivalent Omicron booster do not make appreciably high levels of virus-fighting antibodies against the BA.4 and BA.5 strains than people who received the original booster. That means, as most people already know, getting the booster does not mean you will not get infected with the virus. The booster does, however, keep people from developing severe COVID-19 illness. So Offit says it still provides critical protection for the elderly and people with weakened immune systems. BRR for otherwise people, I think that's supposed to be but for otherwise healthy people, the bivalent shot is protecting against mild illness from Omicron strains that already cause only mild disease to begin with. The experience of the past year has taught us chasing these Omicron variants with a bivalent vaccine is a losing game, says Offit, who also developed the rotavirus vaccine and is director of the Vaccine Education Center at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. When the pandemic began and people had no immunity to the virus, building that immunity with vaccines and booster shots was critical. Now, with most people vaccinated or recovered from bouts of natural infection, that immunity has increased. So most people who get infected with Omicron strains are not getting severely ill. Better data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention about who's getting hospitalized because of COVID-19 could help narrow down which people benefit most from a booster, says Offit. Initially, everybody benefited from getting vaccinated and boosted, he says, but we need to learn who benefits now. The Risk Report by Ian Bremmer, the attack on Brazil's democracy, is not over. When supporters of former President Jair Bolsonaro charged into the Presidential Palace, Congress, and the Supreme Court in Brasilia January 8, they ignited a firestorm that continues to inflame passions. The insurrection was condemned across the political spectrum, including by Bolsonaro himself. Polls suggest 3 out of 4 Brazilians, including large numbers who voted for the former president in the October election, that he lost to Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, popularly known as Lula, were horrified to see the ransacked offices, busted up equipment and furniture, broken windows, and violence between rioters and police. Fewer than 1/5 of Brazilians supported the riots. Authorities in Brazil have taken swift action in response. Of more than 2,000 rioters initially detained, around 1,200 remain under arrest, and dozens have been indicted and have their assets frozen. Investigations into whether perpetrators had inside help will continue, but arrest warrants have already been issued for several government security officials who failed to prevent or stop the violent protests. Bolsonaro's justice minister, Anderson Torres, who was security chief for Brasilia January 14, and was found to be in possession of a draft decree to illegally overturn the results of the election, was arrested Saturday. Supreme Court Justice Alexandre de Moraes also suspended Federal District Governor Ibanez Rocha, a Bolsonaro ally, for 90 days to ensure he will not interfere in the legal process. In addition, the Supreme Court has placed Bolsonaro under investigation for inciting the violence, a charge he denies. The former president faces several additional probes in the Electoral Court over comments made while in office, which could render him ineligible to run for president in 2026. For the moment, a renewal of violence is unlikely, and the newly inaugurated President Lula will probably see a short-term boost in public support. But Brazil's radicalized opposition will not disappear. Though independent experts have dismissed claims of election fraud, public suspicion of the country's establishment has reached its highest point since the end of military rule in 1985. Polls show 40% of Brazilians believe Lula stole the election, and just over 36% favor military intervention to remove him. Many were already angry at what they saw as judicial and political overreach curtailing their free speech rights. Now that the Lula government administration is cracking down on people only loosely connected to the insurrection, this fear of persecution will only increase. As the retaliation expands, so will resentment of a government that many on the right already consider entirely illegitimate. There's another reason this protest movement is likely to last. Unlike those who heeded then-President Donald Trump's figurative call to arms just hours before the ugly protests inside the U.S. Capitol in 2021, Brazil's surge of conspiracy theorists and vandals did not need a sitting president to egg them on. Bolsonaro was already out of office and in Florida when the insurrectionists pushed past Brasilia's barricades, and he'd already offered a half-hearted admission of defeat. Tough economic conditions and too few reliable allies in Congress suggest Lula's boost will be short-lived. As the economy deteriorates, those who consider Lula illegitimate may well take to the streets again. At the very least, large-scale demonstrations and paralyzing strikes will inflict economic and political damage. For now, Brazil's right says Lula has crippled the country's democracy. Brazil's left says the protesters are fascists who never believed in democracy in the first place. And there's no evidence the events of January 8th, dramatic and ugly though they were, have changed many minds. From television, Time Off Reviews, Hello Again, Wisconsin, by Judy Berman. This is a review. That 70s show, the teen comedy that launched Ashton Kutcher and Mila Kunis, ran for a now conceivable 8 seasons thanks to its charismatic cast, stoner humor, and disco decade nostalgia. It wasn't great, but it made for benign background noise and thus became ubiquitous in syndication. Netflix's unasked-for sequel, that 90s show, revisits suburban Wisconsin in 1995 as a grown-up Eric, Topher Grace, and Donna, Laura Prepon, drop off their teenage daughter, Leia, Callie Haverda, for a summer with his parents, Red, Kurtwood Smith, and Kitty, Deborah Jo Rupp. Playing a sweet misfit who finds a crew of her own in her grandparents' neighborhood, Haverda puts a winsome spin on Grace's endearing awkwardness. But most of the cast reads as a bit Disney for storylines about sex and raves. Episodes lean too heavily on Smith and Rupp's all-in-the-family-light characters. Cameos by the original stars feel forced. A laugh track underlines how dire the referential humor can be. Since when did the mere mention of Party of Five qualify as a joke? This is not a sitcom so much as a live-action adaptation of a moldy listicle of things only 90s kids understand. To quote a true teen icon of the era, as if. A couple minutes here for another television review by Judy Berman. An embattled project makes its case in a new medium. The aim of the 1619 project is to recenter American historical discourse around the consequences of slavery and the contributions of Black Americans. In some senses, it's been a victim of its success. Launched in a 2019 issue of the New York Times Magazine that coincided with the 400th anniversary of slavery in the colonies, the acclaimed initiative stoked right-wing outrage. A curriculum released with it became a target of reactionary red state legislation. The project's leader, Nicole Hannah-Jones, has defended it in part by keeping it in the public eye. With the publication of a book and now in a Hulu docuseries of the same name. Given that the six episodes draw heavily on essays that have fueled a book, a curriculum, and a podcast, it is fair to ask whether the TV series is overkill. But stories transcend polemic when viewers see the faces behind them. A provocative episode on capitalism juxtaposes the economics of slavery with the fight to unionize Amazon. That the series is poised to spark fresh controversy only reinforces how much more the 1619 Project has left to say. The 1619 Project arrived on Hulu January 26, and that review was abridged. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.